Welcome to Lives in Leadership. This podcast is dedicated to promoting thoughtful and strategic conversations about military leadership, ethics, culture, and service in the profession of arms within the Australian Defence Force. My name is Dr. Lucas Murray, and in today's episode, I'm joined by Air Vice Marshal Stephen Roberton, also known as Zed. Zed joined the Royal Australian Air Force back in 1989, and throughout his service has been a leader at almost every level, from leading fighter squadrons and wings to commanding the inaugural Air Task Group 630 on Operation Okra, for which he was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. However, his leadership is not only shaped through air combat capability, but he has also held senior appointments, both in defence and in the private sector, including serving as Air Commander Australia and Head Force Design within the Vice Chief of Defence Force Group. Zed, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
I guess my first question is just an open reflection one, reflecting on your years within the Royal Australian Air Force as a fighter pilot and then a commander, participating in international missions. What core qualities do you believe are most important for successful leaders within the military, you know, based on your experience?
Wow, right out of the gate.
Yeah.
I think certainly, having been in industry now for a few years, you come to reflect just how privileged the women and men of the Defence Force are at getting exposed to leadership scenarios very early on in their career. I think that hones some of the key qualities that you really need to be a successful leader. And, you know, to summarise, the four that I think really stand out is people that show and demonstrate and encourage respect. There is no way of hiding that, especially in combat situations or in high stress. You are or you aren't. You can't fake it. The second one, very similarly, is just integrity. When you're under a lot of pressure, leaders show who they really are. And that's one of the great privileges of leadership. When people fear for their lives, or more importantly, when you fear for the lives of those under your care, you can really see what makes people tick. Teamwork is absolutely essential, and probably more so, ironically, in single-seat fighter operations, because you're in your own aeroplane, but you rely on an entire team to bring that together. And then the last one I think has been the cornerstone, certainly, of the fighter community is the excellence, like that just continual pursuit of being the very best that you can be and never being satisfied. So, you know, they're four qualities that I think transcend all branches of the services and key leadership traits of every successful leader I've ever met.
And it seems like you've had to lead people within very complex, you know, operational environments. I'm sure that even within industry, there's some complex environments in that case. What have you learned about leading people within those complex environments?
When I first left the military, I decided to go into an industry looking at different options, but I wanted to go into an area that was going to really push me, to put me most outside of my comfort zone. And I did remark to my wife in the first 6 months, I might have overdone it a couple of times. I felt so far out of my comfort zone. I joined a global consulting outfit, McKinsey and Company, an outstanding outfit. Spent a lot of time in London and Canada. But all of that to say, I'd find myself in boardrooms with CEOs of mining companies or multinationals. And on Monday, I would walk in with that imposter syndrome that so many of us feel, not really sure of the financials or the commerciality or really what the drivers were. But by Tuesday evening, Wednesday, I felt more confident that the fundamental principles of leadership and of what is important, of being able to frame and then analyse a problem, are the same in the military as they are commercially. And so you get a bit more confidence. I say that because quite often by Friday I'd be back to, no, I feel completely out of my depth again. But I think the ability of leaders to pull the best out of a team, you know, that is sort of the core principle.
Zed, that's really fascinating. I think what's interesting is that discussion about that transition from military leadership to, say, private sector leadership. And it's really interesting to hear that you found it quite similar in the fact of leading certain teams. Is there anything that you think is distinctly different? Like what kind of aspects or things that you think are really important that only are kind of important within the military in terms of leadership?
I think the military aspect of command and that legal authority that comes in the military, and of course the trauma and the responsibility when you're dealing with taking lives, and that legal authority from government to be able to in fact to be tasked to go and execute sort of lethal authority, that is something that you probably think a little bit about as a junior officer, but when you're actually, in command of those folks that are doing it, and more importantly, that you see the aftermath and the impact that can have on the people that you're leading, it really hits home. So that's one clear difference. There's more generic differences. The military, we tend to have just an endless supply of very talented young women and men coming through the system that can do, that will always step up to the plate. I don't think there's ever been a generation that hasn't underestimated the capacity of the next generation just to deal with the problems that we've had. I have enormous faith and optimism in the folks that are coming through. But there are some differences too, and I think two of them would be, if you relate it to the commercial area anyway, there's no training or real requirement most of the time for military leaders to understand the difference between, price, cost and value, in both the commercial sense and how things work. And I think we can be subject within the military or defence organisation of not valuing time and people's time to the extent that is required in the commercial settings. But they're on the edges. Leadership is leadership.
Yeah, definitely. I worked for a little bit in emergency services, in which, it takes a certain type of leader there to deal with the sorts of kind of life and death situations that not at all like the military, but it's a different context and a different sort of, leader thrives in that environment to say in industry. And I think what's interesting is to think about those differences and similarities across. Even within the military, there's different sorts of leaders, right?
Absolutely.
Operational leaders compared to, say,
yeah. And very different cultures. Training. The services have very different cultures between them by necessity.
Yeah.
I was enormously shaped by, I did an exchange tour for a couple of years with the United States Marine Corps, and I flew off carriers and I did Top Gun and NSOC and those sort of courses over there. But when you watch how the Marine Corps operates, let alone the broader US military, there is a lot to learn. There's a few things to be avoided too, but there's a lot to learn from an organisation like that. And it really shaped who I was and how I acted and reacted as a commander later on.
Do some of the service cultures, like within the Air Force, are there similarities with that culture of Air Force within Australia to other militaries around the world and their sort of Air Force cultures?
Yeah, I would say, for instance, that the air mobility wings and the air mobility group within Australia, in many ways, has by design more in common with the United States Air Force mobility than it does with, for instance, the fighter community within the Royal Australian Air Force. Fighter communities, especially within the Western Air Forces, they're pretty similar in what they value, in their training types, in the discipline. And so the real fun part is when you bring all of them together with, and you're in a Canberra environment with not just different subcultures within your service, but Navy, Army, Australian public servants, contractors, and you're pulling this team together, frankly, it's, Ricky Ponting would comment, it's pretty easy to lead the Australian cricket team when you've got this team full of rock stars. Actually, when it gets really tricky is when you've got the Saturday afternoon park team pulled together down in your local community and you're trying to work out who's going to do what and to get to the mission success.
That's a great analogy, actually. Yeah, depending on the team. I want to pivot a little bit to an operation, but I actually want to hear about that management of different sorts of cultures and teams within this operation. So Operation Okra, is it Okra? Is that the...
Mm.
Yep. Air Task Group, you worked alongside coalition forces from several countries, and the operation consisted of, from what I know, 400 RAF personnel and a range of aircraft, E-7, FA-18s, KC-30s, which I think the largest air task group to deploy from Australia since the Vietnam War. So under your command, Air Task Group 630 conducted airstrikes. They flew in support of Iraqi and Kurdish ground forces. They assisted in freeing, is it Yazidi?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. The Yazidi people trapped in the Sinjar Mountains. And in recognition of your role in this operation, you were awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. I was reading this transcript about that deployment. And I just wanted to ask you if you could speak a little bit about Operation Okra and some of the challenges that you've experienced. You know, you're managing three types of aircraft and aircraft crews, and I can imagine that would be quite challenging.
There was some unique aspects about Okra, which you've pointed out. It was our first self-deployed air task group since Vietnam. Never before in the recent decades and the previous four decades had we the ability within Australia to stand up a strike force with all of the supporting elements and deploy 12,000 kilometres. We did that autonomously without assistance from, for example, the US and their enablers. We did it at fairly short notice. What's
short notice, just for my context?
You can imagine that across the Australian Defence Force, and there are all of the capabilities have certain readiness notices within which they must react, and obviously some are shorter than others with how quickly you can imagine things like counter-terrorism need to be pretty much ready to go, and
right. Some
of the air transports are very key to be able to launch quickly. Roles and scenarios where fighters were anticipated to be used had longer lead times in those days, and this is 2014, but the Abbott government at the time was watching what was going on in Iraq and the Levant and, the massive impact that it was having over there on them, and the US call for a reaction to it. And so it was very quick for the US, for the Australian government to ask us to actually deploy into theatre. So we deployed within 19 days notice from government and we're ready to go on combat operations
that
quickly.
Now,
we did it with some clear help from the US in terms of weapons that were in theatre and the like, but that was a lot to organise because we had to have somewhere to base out of. We had to work out what support arrangements we'd need, what sort of contribution we could make, how we'd work out, the legal authorities, the rules of engagement and collateral damage assessments and the like. And then, of course, just what could we sustain over there on that sort of deployment. So in terms of the complexity, it was a rapid form of key elements. But the three aircraft that we used were, ironically, it was the first time they were relatively new aircraft, all three of them, to the Air Force. I had the great privilege of leading the Super Hornet introduction into service. And stood that up from day one in terms of a project. It was a rapid project done under the Howard government when Brendan Nelson was the defence minister. It was very quickly brought into service, approval in a matter of months and then in service in Australia in just a couple of years. So I not only got to stand up the project and then command the wing subsequently, but then to actually be part of the chain of command in combat. We had a very good team. The Wedgetail, the E-7 Wedgetail, is the world-leading airborne early warning aircraft type, but not used in combat operations. And so deploying it and understanding the footprint of support that you would need and the security arrangements, how we could facilitate that. And then the Tanker Force, we had the KC-30, which again was, I'd argue, still one of the best of its type in the world for the capacity that you can fit just with the number of passengers on board, supporting maintenance and support personnel, but the amount of fuel that can offload. And so that all turned around very, very quickly. We had some C-130s already in theatre. So all of that to say the three different communities and types and our combat support element, the fourth but essential element, were well practised but not together and not formed up in a near task group and then rapidly deployed and ready to go.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I can imagine, like you said, they have quite different personnel, quite different operational kind of readiness, and to have that, I don't know, to be forced to kind of be out there so quickly, 19 days seems really quick.
Yeah, it was an exercise in, logistics and planning really rapidly done. But the more fundamental parts were, there's no framework initially in theatre for, where we were going to operate, how we were going to sync in with the US, UK, and then later French, and then the many European and Middle Eastern ally nations that formed part of that unique command and control arrangements, where we're going to operate, deconflicting, how we were going to meet the government intent, but do it in a way that was going to meet, the safety and standards and respectful of the differences, the fundamental differences, for example, between the United States and the way they applied rule of engagement and the way we do in Australia.
Can I ask how can you do that well? Like, how do you understand the sort of cross-cultural element of working with those sort of multinational militaries? Like, are there things that you try to bring to the table, or is it about being curious and listening? Like, how can you provide advice for future leaders maybe being in those sorts of scenarios, and how to navigate all those sorts of differences of culture, but also differences of knowing where Australia kind of sits within that global stage? How do you navigate those sort of complexities?
It is a great question, and it goes to the fundamental underpinnings of successful command, and especially for military leaders within the Australian environment. It really comes down still to relationships and building those quickly, or leveraging those that already exist. We have great long-standing exchanges with the United States, United Kingdom, especially between aircrew, engineering support, logistics. So having that understanding of how they operate and how we operate is a good starting point. The exercise infrastructure that we do annually is very important. But getting over there in theatre, being able to sit down and quickly ascertain not just sort of what's important to you and your nation, but yes, where are the red lines, and this is what's important to us, and having very candid, professional, non-partisan, non-culturally biased conversations is important. One of the secondary roles that I ended up having is the inaugural commander, which was probably the most important thing that I did, but not really related to the Australian aspect, is as the operation went on and started to mature, there was the United States and the UK just before us. The French were already in theatre, but came on board and started operating in the counter-ISIL strike as a coordinated group just after Australia. We subsequently had about another 13 nations join. Nations from Europe, so, the Dutch, Danes, all manner of folks from the European theatre, as well as a whole bunch of nations within the Middle East itself. Very, very different national objectives, very, very different cultural backgrounds, and of course, alignments or loyalties to different factional groups on the ground. This was a largely Sunni v. Shia, to overly simplify the issues, but that played out very, very importantly, because the ground commander, Iraqi forces that were clearing the strikes may not have necessarily been aligned to the areas where you were striking. So all of that to say, a lot of the nations wanted to be sort of aligned, and the US, being very clever, delegated to me as the Australian inside the Five Eyes, but no sort of colonial baggage that the UK might have had, and I ended up coordinating the international leaders of the air task groups, only of the air forces, and literally sat down in a room from day one, just went around the table, what is your country trying to get out of this? What do you want? What are going to be the restrictions? And we had a very candid conversation in largely broken English and a little bit of French at times, which I struggled with. And it was a fascinating experience. And then we ended up doing that weekly to say, how are you going? How do we make, like, in order for us to succeed over here, we have to abide by what's important to Australia and the Australian government, the Australian people, be rigidly enforcing the ethical principles and maintain that social license that we had, but making sure that we're very respectful for what the Dutch or the Italians might want, more importantly, what some of the Middle Eastern nations were trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. And And it became just a way, I guess, of having candid professional conversations that weren't judgmental, but accepting and building that team so that in order for any of us to succeed, we all should.
It's so fascinating because I'm an anthropologist. I don't know if you know. And something that fascinates me is the way in which, you know, we talk about, I really love the way in which you were talking about sort of relationships and communication that weren't transactional and influence in the way we think about influencing others. And I think what's interesting anthropologically is the way in which, and you maybe experience this, how others are trying to influence you. I find that fascinating within specifically that context because, yes, you're trying to build authentic kind of relationships, open lines of communication. But how do you, and maybe what advice do you have to future leaders of how to navigate the complicated space of, hey, I'm trying to influence others because we have a nation state mission, and but they do as well. And that can get very tricky in terms of knowing when you're being influenced or knowing when you're being, you know, you're not given all the information or you're thinking that maybe this person is trying to, you know, they think about Australia in this sort of context and they want us to, you know, speak to these people for this sort of reason. Like, I know I'm not being very specific, but are there, does that elicit any kind of emotions or thought from you, perhaps your experience working in these multinational sort of environments?
Yeah, I think we see it even today in the Indo-Pacific area.
Yes.
But certainly back then, the country's quite clearly stated that we want the Aussies to sort of help lead this because we won't feel as intimidated or overseen as we would with the US,
right.
But they're inside the Five Eyes, they're inside the close knit, and so we'll get a straight shot at what is important, what is not. I think some of the key elements for a commander is just that ability to do a little bit of research, not a lot. I'd served in Iraq in 03 previously with the air campaign over there as well. And so had some insight, and I had been back there once. I'd had great relationship with a few folks on Staff College, and I knew just enough to know that I did not know very much at all and just how complex the multiple layers of the Middle East really were. And so that allows you to go in with a mindset of just to listen and then just build the trust. Trust is built up through transparency, so I would open and say, look, this is what is really important to Australia. This is why we're here.
Yeah,
this is probably our red lines. This is where we differ about how can we help for you to succeed and how can we make sure that your government will look favourably on your actions over here and contributing to what we all thought was a very, very important mission.
And that sounds really clear for them. Like, I want to help you, but here are sort of my boundaries and red lines, as you said. Have you ever encountered people that, you know, don't play the same game?
For sure.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
The second key element is I never would take it personally.
That's good.
And some people will get emotional, quite rightly, because it's very important to them. Some people have, you know, religious or tribal affiliations which people that are either suffering or they're being on the other side of the problem that's being faced there. But I don't, you know, suffer those that sort of tie-in, so you can actually just respect what they're saying. You don't have to agree with it, making sure that you're hearing it, repeating back to it for your own clarity so that, you know, in the readback saying, so what I'm understanding is that this is important to you. Sometimes you'll have people that'll have a conflict situation in, and I'm talking about the military environment extends beyond that. And often I would, rather than question the 10% of things that they think they were vociferously disagreeing with, I'd say, so as I understand it, these are the things we already agree on, and lay that out about what was important and just find those common areas. I know it sounds a little bit trite and a little bit kind of Instagram leadership, but it genuinely was the way that you built the trust in the room, and everyone knew that, you know, we would respect each other's views, we'd be very discreet about it, and I certainly didn't want them going out repeating what I had said was Australia's position on things. I said, no, this is my interpretation of what our government wants and this is how we're going to execute. All I can say is it became very important in how we pursued the mission over there.
No, it sounds like you were very authentic and clear and you adapted well to that situation. You know, some people might want a silver bullet. You know, this is how relationship building happens across a multi. No, you're kind of describing that adaptability and that agility that you had on the ground to kind of make sense of the context and the people that you're working with. And that's so important, I think, when we're talking about relationships and we're talking about people.
It came at a bit of a personal cost. Those who have ever lived or served in the Middle East will know I drank gallons of Turkish coffee and ate a ridiculous number of high-calorie dates and would be happy if I never had to face either ever again. Mm-hmm. But such was the way that was comfortable for many of the people in the room. And so we went through the process. Yeah, and it was interesting.
How challenging. it sounds amazing. Yeah. I guess I'll pivot a little bit just because we're about 20 minutes in. I hope you don't mind me asking, but it's just been 1 year now since the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide released its findings. For some context, the final report included 122 recommendations to government, which formed the Royal Commission's blueprint for real, meaningful and long-lasting reform, such as improving support for veterans and their families. Leadership and cultural change was one of the recommendations. And many of these recommendations revolve around systemic change to ADF culture, leadership responsibility, operational support, areas where, your experience in the military, command and planning and security and capability development would, I think, provide some valuable insights. Like, where do you see as the most critical areas, that the Defence Force and veteran support systems need to focus more moving forward? And how can leadership, do you think, at all levels contribute to a meaningful change in this space?
It's a really important national issue. And of course, it goes well beyond just the military. I know a lot of our first responders and community service people, and they do, they do serve as we do in the military. They don't enjoy the same level of attention and respect and support that we do in the military. I think the military is doing a really good job. I think the Australian Defence response to the High Commission report has been. Genuine, and they're trying to make real big changes. There's probably, still some way to go. I absolutely acknowledge that. I think at a leadership level, one of the key principles is you don't get to decide yourself what can trigger or cause, real concern in one of your colleagues. I have seen that even in peacetime over the years. I've suffered through, having colleagues and friends die in aircraft accidents, especially in the 90s, but with my time with the United States Marine Corps and then later with the Navy. And sometimes there were people who were there in support, really hardworking, dedicated maintainers who saw the aircraft off and then have this question, even though all logic shows quite clearly they had no contribution to what led to an accident or the death of one of the pilots, but they carry that burden. Mm. And I think we need to be very mindful that sometimes people that are operating in the environment, for instance, in the drone environment at the moment, and the number of missions and strikes that we executed and cleared, but there are people sitting in there in the combined air operations centre, huge big screens in front of them, and literally watching death. That can really affect people in ways that may not be obvious to others, and it shouldn't be up to us to judge. I think that's a lot more commonly understood now in a world of, the first person drones and the video footage we see in Ukraine, and but you got to understand 10 years ago that did not exist. But I do think it's a key tenet of our leadership to make sure we respect that different people are going to react in different ways, and what's more, they may not be predictable, it may not manifest for some time afterwards.
Yeah, no, nicely said. And I'm really interested in hearing your thoughts, perhaps on that future of technology and AI and warfighting. Like, what do you see as sort of challenges in that space, or sort of any advice for leaders kind of navigating this new future?
I think it is going to be an enormous change, but so was the bow and arrow, so was the rifle, so was the catapult.
So you're saying the nature of war is sort of still the same in some regard?
I do. I just think that the tempo is changing. It's changing very rapidly. And now the, there's some wonderful old writing from, you know, centuries past about the depersonalization of warfare by the use of catapults and the like. I think that the propensity, perhaps the opportunity to be disconnected from the application of lethal force is even greater with AI and the rapid movement, and that makes it even more important that there is a fundamental check and balance of alignment with our ethics and the inculcation of that within the leadership at every step of the way. So I think the role of ethics and leadership in the modern military is far more important than it ever was, simply because the rate of change and the technology can even more easily make things depersonalized. And I would argue that there is no greater consequence, or that you never get more human than when you're looking at taking someone else's life. And that's about as human as it gets, and the impacts can be very long lasting.
Zed, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's been a fascinating conversation. We've covered lots of different topics. Great to have you at the college, and yeah, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. I enjoyed it.
This episode of Lives in Leadership is copyright Commonwealth of Australia, Department of Defence 2025. It is licensed under a Creative Commons, by attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives 4.0 international license. Additional rights beyond this license can be arranged by contacting the.forge@defence.gov.au. For full license details, visit creativecommons.org.